Hey everybody, and welcome to Front End Fire, the weekly show that helps you stay up to date on the latest and the greatest in the front end world. I am your host today, TJ Van Tol. I have Jack Harrington with me.
Hey everybody.
And we have a special guest joining us this week. We have Jason Langsdorf. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Awesome.
Yeah. So for people that have not heard your stuff before, seen your content, you want to tell people a little bit about the sort of stuff you do, who you are, why you're famous, all those good sorts of things?
I may be stretching with that one, but I am a engineer turned developer educator. I worked for a long time as like a full stack dev, front end architect at IBM, and then went into the DevRel side of the house. When I got into startups like Gatsby and Netlify, I ended up, I was the VP of dev experience, and then the acting VP of marketing at Netlify when I stepped away. And that all led to me taking this kind of interesting sidestep in the end of 22, where I've been doing developer focused media consulting. So I'm kind of working with companies to just make more interesting stuff, because I was sick of webinars and I was sick of kind of the same old thing, and I wanted to make something better. That's what I was doing at Netlify, and now I'm trying to do that with as many companies as want to do it.
No, it's funny because I sympathize with you greatly, because I feel like, because I've been in developer relations for a long time, and I feel like when COVID hit, there was this push to do everything online, but it was all just the same generic format. Like, well, let's just do a webinar, just do this same old video. And so I've appreciated some of the stuff you've been doing to try to mix it up and more interesting stuff, because I feel like there's so much more potential for the sort of stuff we do to tell stories more interestingly, to present this content.
I think so. And I think if we look around at like what other industries are doing, we're actually kind of behind in engineering. So there's a lot of opportunity for ways that we can just make the space more fun and kind of re-embrace that idea of like we all came in here because we're builders and we're creators. And I think that post-pandemic and with the sweep of layoffs and everything, it's kind of gone more toward like protective, like, oh, I have to learn this because if I don't, I'll get fired, or oh, I have to do this because if I don't, the AI will take my job. And so if we can re-embrace the fun and the exploration and the creativity of this, it continues to future-proof us, but it makes us feel less bad along the way.
Yeah, it's amazing how much inspiration I get now from just random YouTubers, interestingly enough, from just completely other worlds, like general tech or whatever,
totally,
for ideas, what they're doing, or people like yourselves. We have some famous YouTubers right here on the show. All right, well, I know we're going to dig into this a little bit more, so why don't we hop straight into our news for the week?
Woohoo!
Jack, do you want to kick us off? I think you've got some nice YouTube drama to start
sure.
us off.
Sure. I've got
start
news of the week. Stupid this week. God. So the Let Const debate somehow continues. And I guess I played some amount of a role in that. So
some amount?
Some amount. Like a couple of weeks ago now, Ryan Florence gave a talk called Let Me Be, which is ironic because he was totally not asking to be let be. He was actually just asking to be at the center of all attention by basically saying in kind of that we shouldn't be using const. That's the whole gist of it. And he's been advocating for this position for years. I remember the first time I actually saw a remix presentation with him, and I think there was Michael Jackson on there as well. Michael Jackson on the remix team, not Michael Jackson. That you know, they were using let inside of a component, and I'm just like, what? Why? And I thought it was a bug, and it turns out no, they're very adamantly serious about really using let over const continuously. So he gave this presentation, and I didn't find it all that compelling personally, and I wasn't going to engage, except that I noticed that a lot of folks seem to be taking it very seriously, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess I gotta say something. So I made a video on kind of breaking it down point by point, and that kind of reinvigorated the controversy again, and it's been really interesting seeing all the feedback from it. I did a poll yesterday on Twitter and asking people if you had some mission critical thing, like there's literally like there's a you had to store whether the docking, you know, whether you, whether you're docked on the space station in order to know that you should be able to open the hatch. And if you get this wrong, people could die. Like, do you want to use a const or a let? And it was literally, I did the math this morning, it was 80-20 in favor of let. 80, full on. Yeah, I mean, we always talk about 80-20. Turns out 80% folks would want to, and you know, 20% of one in every five JavaScript developers is like, damn the torpedoes, let's go. Let's, you know, let's do let. You know, kind of crazy, but yeah.
I think that that question, though, misses the bigger problem, which is that we're writing spaceship code in JavaScript.
Yeah. a bunch of folks on Twitter came, were like, what? The funny thing is, they actually do.
Yeah. Right, because there's Node on the Mars lander, right? Isn't that the...
Well, there's Node, I think there's at least Web. I don't know if it's React Web or Vue, I have no idea, on the Dragon space capsule.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that there's microservices behind it that are like Rust and Go, and I'm sure that like if you tried to open the hatch within the UI and the Go service is like, no, don't do that. I mean, that's obviously
Clippy pops
levels.
Up and is like, are you, it looks like you're trying to open the door into the vacuum. Are you sure that's what you want to do?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah, undefined is not an object and the door just won't open. So, Jason, we got you on the show, so we got to ask you, are you team let or const in this situation?
Oh, boy.
I am team uninterested in this conversation, to be completely honest. I find that like the very technical reasons that people debate things like const are, they're valid, but they're edge cases, right? And the choice to use let everywhere is like different, but it's not wrong. And so my general take on this is, as long as the team is consistent, I really don't care. It's more when it turns into like some of the code does things one way and some of the code does it another way because individual developers are sort of turf warring inside of a code base. That's when I start to take issue. But I think as long as your prettier is consistent, do whatever you want.
Yeah, and I'm with you. And I think that's why it's so nice we have, nowadays we have ESLint and prettier and such to just enforce this, because I also don't really care all that much for 99% of times. It doesn't really matter in these situations, but it can matter if you run into code that doesn't work like you expect it to, or there's different patterns, different things are inconsistent. That's where you run into weird stuff. So I'm with you. I think that's a pretty good take on this.
I disagree, but it's only because I would say that I don't care because it, as often as I've seen it, most folks go with const, so it's never really been an issue. And then then occasionally these kind of weird things come up and you're like, what? But I gotta say, like, I've seen so many comments on my own video on this, and you know, you get this little fraction of folks who are like, it's an aesthetic choice. And I'm like, it's not an aesthetic choice. This is a programming language. This isn't like, you know, iambic pentameter in English. This isn't like, I mean, this is not an aesthetic choice. This is a computer we're talking about. There's, you know, I just, that one I don't understand.
I mean, I think like until you get into some pretty serious, I can see why people would think it's an aesthetic choice. And I don't even know that I would argue, because functionally, except for the edge cases, let and const are the same thing.
Yeah, fair.
Right. I mean, and so it's, to me, it's sort of like the semicolons, no semicolons thing. Like, I have my own very strong opinions about how I will write my code regarding semicolons. But if you choose to do it otherwise, I'm not going to like submit a pull request to fix your prettier. I don't care that much.
No.
Yeah.
I agree.
That's why this makes good YouTube content and good.
It actually is the best kind of YouTube content, because it's something that we can feel strongly about, and it is ultimately meaningless. So nobody's ever objectively right. Right. Like they're because the choice doesn't matter in the truest sense of the word. We can argue passionately. We can be objectively correct in all of our arguments, and it still has no impact on like anybody's day to day life. So it's just fun. It's like tab versus spaces, right? Like there are some very good objective reasons to use tabs over spaces, mainly in the accessibility space.
Yeah.
But outside of the accessibility space, there's really no reason, right? And so obviously use tabs because it's more accessible, because none of the other arguments matter. But it creates this fun little argument where you can have these strong, you know, it's like liking a color. Like, yeah, we can argue about what your favorite color is all day, but it doesn't matter. It's my favorite color. Like, you can disagree, but you're, you know, if you're inside my head, you're wrong.
Jack puts on his mental to-do list to switch to tabs for like the 15,000th time.
So we will have a link to the video itself in the show notes. If you want to get involved in the video, make sure to watch the video and then leave a super strong comment. Jack will love that. Just pick a side, dig in, get involved.
Absolutely.
I think that's the proper way to handle this situation.
I think the real way we should go about this is we should probably create a global object that's called variables and instantiate it with var. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And then every time you want a variable, you just do variables dot whatever the thing is. Because then we don't have to argue it.
What's crazy is I thought we were done with var. Like, I thought that was, like, just let in concert is inherently superior to var, period. Like, at a technical level. Like, why? How did that come back? What? Stop. No, please.
All right. I think it's time to move on to our next news item before we
take
this into the ground. So I wanted to talk about this library that I've just found out exists. Have either of you heard of the Effect Library?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had not. So I heard of it for the first time because I caught that they had a 3.0 release, which they call their first stable release. So I went down the rabbit hole of, yeah, it's also kind of weird for 3.0 to be your first stable release. But they, I went down the rabbit hole, read their blog posts, looked up their library a little bit. They describe themselves as the missing standard library for TypeScript, and that they are a toolkit that you can use and pick and choose the pieces that make the most sense for your use case. So in that sense, they're Lodash and underscore like, except whereas Lodash and underscore are basically utility functions, like I need to work with arrays in a different way. This is a library for more, I want to say, like production or large scale problems. So it has better tooling for better error management, for observability. Like if you need logging, metrics, tracing, dependency injection, concurrency, composition, all these like harder, more important sounding terms that you might not run into when you're building up a little blog or something simple. But if you're orchestrating an entire component library or entire library that you're going to use in a giant app or a corporate ecosystem, these are problems that legitimately come up. So have either of you tried this before? Because I messed around with just the absolute basics, but I, like I said, I had just run into this for the very first time.
So I haven't built with it, but I reviewed the API. I kind of looked through their code samples and tried to get a sense of how it all fits together. And it felt like something that has a lot of really strong arguments in favor of why you would adopt it, and one very strong counter argument that I think nullifies them all, which is that you have to retrain your entire team on how to write code if you choose to use the library. And this is the same argument. I went all in on functional programming a while back. I got really excited about the idea of, like, because there are a lot of really strong reasons why functional programming eliminates a whole category of bugs. It's like there are like great arguments for why you should use functional programming. And so I got excited. I started using it everywhere. You know, everything was getting rewritten as these single argument curried functions. And I was like, wow, this is amazing.
No.
This is going to be so good. And like, it was easy for me to maintain my code, and I lost every single contributor on the rest of my team, open source, everything, because nobody else understood how it worked. And when I thought about it for a minute, I was like, wait, I spent weeks learning how to do this so that I could write code this way. And to expect other people to onboard into this who don't have the weeks that I spent plus the 15 years of experience that I had at that point to jump in and write code like this, like I'll never onboard my team. Like, it's hard enough to get JavaScript engineers to write good JavaScript, let alone, you know, to write good JavaScript in addition to writing some completely different framework with all of its own kind of invented patterns and APIs and various ways of thinking about data and new jargon and all that kind of stuff. So my gut feel on it is that it is a very, very good library that will not see adoption because the adoption curve is just too steep.
I think it'll probably see niche adoption because honestly, when I saw a lot of their code samples, it reminded me of the Java code that I used to write years ago because that is more, Java code tends to come with more ceremony, and then it's subjective as to whether that ceremony and stuff is providing value or if it's clutter getting in the way. It's probably a little bit of both. But it reminded me of that. So I feel like people that also come from that sort of background that are looking for that sort of stuff would probably find some use out of this, but it's a bit of a niche in the JavaScript world. I feel like that most apps aren't approaching code from this sort of perspective. So I tend to agree with you. There is one random fact that blew my mind at the end of this article, and Jack's going to laugh at this, I know for sure. did you know that Effect has, I'm going to quote them, quote, raised a seed round of $2.2 million led by Amplify Partners
within participation are you
early adopters. How are these, where are these people funding these libraries?
Why do I worry about other people's money?
I mean,
there's some like random pool of VC money out there that needs to be quote unquote activated.
Yeah,
I mean, so they randomly activate it all over these little projects.
How do you monetize?
I have no idea.
That. Like, how do you monetize Lodash?
I don't know.
I'm just trying to imagine that, like, is there going to come a 4.0 release where you have to put in an API key for any of the functions to work? Like,
I don't know. It's so weird. I'm just fascinated by, like you said, Jack. I mean, good for them. Great if you can register money. Good for you. But I also am in the same boat of like, I don't know. I mean, we wonder this with a lot of different tech that's raising this money, but this one feels like the biggest stretch I've seen so far, just because of the nature of what this is. It is open source. It is MIT licensed, so it's just out there on GitHub if you want to check it out. But it's just strange. That
maybe when you install it, you can put up a link for swag, make some money off that.
Well, and I think the thing that I've noticed is that with a lot of the open source tools, and this is actually something that I thought, you know, I joined Gatsby, we're one of the early wave of like VC funded dev tools at least in the latest cohort, and all roads lead to a cloud.
Yep.
And the challenge that I see with that is that, you know, in Gatsby's case, it led to them kind of neglecting the things that the open source user base wanted in favor of trying to build this data layer that they could monetize. And, you know, in the case of Next.js, it's led to this sort of like contentious relationship where open source frameworks like Nuxt and Astro and these others, they're not incentivized to put you on their cloud. So they have these open deployment APIs, like adapter APIs, but Next is heavily incentivized to not build that so that you know, it really only works on Vercel. And so it's this sort of like inherently broken model where if you fund an open source project, they have to find a way to make it closed in some way. So they find a piece of value that they think they can gate typically in a cloud. And that then becomes a thing. So like Astro is taking a different route and saying, we're going to monetize the database, right? So they're doing a cloud hosted SQLite database and hoping that that provides enough revenue that the open source project is, you know, basically a driving adoption source for them. And hopefully, I really hope that works because it would be great to prove that model. But I just don't know how this works for some of these tools. Like, you know, and we keep seeing it not work. Like Prisma, it's not quite working, and Apollo, it's not quite working. And so, like, how, I don't know how we break this cycle. I feel like, you know, I'm very, very happy that people are getting paid to work on open source. I am very concerned about what that means for, like, does that mean that people will only choose to work on open source if they can get a $2.2 million seed round? And then we're kind of in this, that gets a little dystopian.
Yeah, that's kind of
so,
weird.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, who's going to work on, like, what does that mean for stuff like Node.js, where we have this great volunteer base? At some point, are people just going to say, well, I'm not going to work on Node because I can get seed funding to work on Bun? Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You fork it or you create your own, because I mean, Dino has the model. They've got their cloud, Dino Deploy or whatever. Bun has funding. So the answer clearly today, at least, seems to be, well, you create your competitor and you raise money and you try to dethrone the king. That's mm-hmm. basically the model. And, you know, there's something to be said. I mean, a lot of these tools still stay free. Well, the cloud part is where this gets tricky, but I mean, Bun has done a lot to push the Node ecosystem forward already. So it's tricky in terms of what's the best for the ecosystem, what's the best for individual developers. I think the biggest thing to me is I still just have to be amused by when I see some of these numbers come up, because some of them just seem completely nonsensical.
I gotta say, okay, hold on. I think there might be something here. So at a previous life, I was doing a static analysis tool of code bases.
Yeah.
And I think given effect, right? If you wanted to say, okay, my application is correct, we handle all of the error cases, yada, yada, yada. I think actually having effect as a kind of a standard for that, you could tool around that and actually like look at the entire code base and say, cool, you know, we have a decent percentage of confidence that all of the error cases of our API handling or whatever are covered. And that was one of the cool things that I thought about effect actually the first time I saw it. And that's actually like the only thing I've really looked into it is the whole error handling thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you can do a good job at like helping applications become more robust and providing some tooling around that, I think there could be something there, right?
Definitely, because I mean, we've seen that happen with things like OpenAPI. Because what was that company called, SmartBear or whatever? They were at least able to get to an acquisition. I don't think they ever really made money off of OpenAPI, but they created enough value that they at least got something for their efforts, right? And I think that like Open Feature right now is trying to do the same thing inside of the feature flag space, and OpenTelemetry really like gave New Relic a run for its money to the point that they ended up taking a private equity deal because the other the OTel friendly companies were eating their lunch, as far as I can understand. And you know, so there is something to be said about creating open standards. I think the challenge is when you're looking at something like Effect, where it's not a simple adoption path, and it's not an adoption path that like just your observability engineers, you know, have to make a few changes in the boilerplate of the code to make it work everywhere. It's like, no, your whole code base really needs to adopt this, and your whole engineering team really needs to adopt this, or else it's not going to get that full benefit. I see where you're coming from, Jack, and I do think that would be a great, I mean, it'd be super cool, right? Like there are a lot of issues with things like concurrency in JavaScript that are really challenging, but I don't know how we convince everybody to, you know, it's like state machines. Like we all know state machines are objectively correct, but nobody's going to take the time to write the boilerplate. So we just write if statements and Boolean flags.
And then have, and then have David like come up on us on Twitter. Yeah. Like, yeah, go to the state machine. Show me a state machine. Yeah. Every time. It's amazing about that.
All right. Well, for our last thing today, Jason, I know you've been working on some cool stuff that you want to talk about a little bit. So why don't we transition over to that? What sort of stuff have you been working on? I know Jack's been a part of some of your content lately too.
Yeah. So I've been doing a series where the premise is I just want stuff to be more focused on like the fun and the collaboration and the creativity of things. And in the name of that, I put together a series called Four Web Devs, One App Idea. And the way that it's structured is really similar to a series that I saw from Andrew Huang, which was four producers flip the same sample. It's about music. And then before Andrew, there was another one that was called Four Photographers Shoot the Same Model from Jessica Colbasi. And so it's a format that I've seen across YouTube, and I thought it was really well done. And I made a few episodes all remote, but it was missing some of the community part that I really wanted. And so the most recent episode and a few future episodes that are currently like booked and kind of coming up, we're shooting in person in my studio here in where I'm at right now, my studio in Portland. And we bring in three devs plus me, an advisor from a sponsor's company, and then we get a challenge. Like Jack, our challenge was build an AI app that's not another chatbot. And you're going to do that using AstraDB's vector store as a component in the build.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we get together in the morning, we've got 30 minutes to plan, we got 4 hours to build, and then we all demo together, go get a nice dinner the evening after. And it's just, it was like everything that I've wanted of seeing people build. We were all kind of, you know, we're sitting at this, you know, next to each other. So we're able to sort of go over to each other's desks and like ask each other questions and trade ideas. And it was just such a, it was like what I've been missing since the pandemic, where I, you know, cause I haven't worked in an office since 2017, and being able to have that experience of, you know, like, oh, Jack, what are you working on? I just rolled over to his desk and looked at his screen.
Yeah,
for a
minute. Was really fun. That was a great part of it.
It's so nice, yeah. Right? And it was great, too, because, like, when I got stuck, I could just turn around and say, hey, Carter. Carter was the DataStax rep who was helping with AstroDB stuff. I was like, Carter, can you come look at this? Because I'm pretty sure there's an easier way to solve this than what I'm doing. And he'd come look over my shoulder and point at a couple things, and we'd solve problems, right? It was such a nice collaborative environment, and I left with so much energy for building more things. Despite being in an area that I have no, like I'd never written, I didn't even know what a vector store was before this challenge. And I didn't really understand how all the LLM stuff worked, you know, cause I've been pretty skeptical about AI in general. I've been waiting to see if it was going to go the way of crypto, and it looks like it didn't. It looks like it's here to stay. So now I'm trying to learn it. but, you know, as I'm doing that, I'm like going into this space that traditionally, I would have felt super intimidated, really hesitant to start, really like just overwhelmed by. But instead, it became this really fun thing that I did with my friends, and I came out having learned something at the other end. And so, anyways, I'm really excited about it. I've got more planned, and we're also opening it up to the community so that people who would like to get involved can actually build their own version. The episode that Jack was on, the contest closed, I think, as of, you said this is releasing on Monday, so as of today, that contest just closed. But we're going to do another one with the next episode. So if you're interested in like building up your portfolio and learning stuff with friends, that's what we're doing now. We're going to film these. We're going to open it up to the community, let people play, and hopefully everybody has a lot of fun, learns new stuff, and builds up their portfolios.
Can you talk a little bit about the logistics and the production value that goes into this? Because as I understand it, you've basically built a movie studio at mm-hmm. your place, and
yes.
you almost have to have, because I think what makes YouTube work in a lot of sense is sometimes you see these videos, like these Mr. Beast videos that are 10-minute video, and you don't appreciate how much goes into carefully curating that and the production value and how much edit video they had to do to split it down. So that's something that I feel like you're blazing new trails of doing this in the world of development. There's not a whole lot of people doing that. So can you just talk a little bit about, like, logistically, how is this working? Like, how are you filming this? How are you mm-hmm. cutting it? How are you taking it? Because then you also have multiple video streams that you have to cut down. What are some of, like, the behind the scenes of making this happen?
So behind the scenes, I am working with a production crew. I have a director of photography, assistant camera, sound engineer. And then I'm working as the producer and writer, and we're bringing in all the devs from out of town. So, you know, we got to get people into hotels. We got to get flights coordinated. We're making sure that lunches are set up and that people are getting here on time. So there's call sheets and all those bits. And then day of, we've got two cameras running plus sound. So everybody's mic'd up. We've got two camera operators. And then we have to do some structure to make sure we get the right footage. So throughout the day, the director of photography is like grabbing the devs and pulling them outside and having a quick conversation, asking them like, hey, how are you feeling about things? How's it going? What are you excited about? What are you worried about? We pull them a few times during the day. And then when we do the demos, we got to make sure that people are recording their screens. We've got to make sure that we've got somebody doing a wide shot, somebody kind of following who's talking and getting a little closer on them. And at the end of it all, I have a 4 terabyte drive, one of these,
yeah, I can imagine.
That's just loaded up with 300 or 400 clips. And then,
oh my God.
I've got to work with my, wow. my
yeah,
editing
shot
team.
In like 4K or something.
So yeah. It's all shot in 4K raw. We're not shooting in RAW. No. Sorry. We're shooting in 4K. It's all log. It's like ProRes something. But they're huge files, right? And then I have to get all those tagged, collated up on I use frame.io for all this stuff. Get that transferred over to my editor, and my editing team is then kind of building out the they call it an assembly. And then from the assembly, I'm doing rough selects of like, this was a good piece of conversation. This was a good bit of B-roll. Like, let's use those. They do the edits. We got to do color correction. We got to do sound mixing. We got to do music. We got to do, you know, all sorts of good stuff. And then there's like the admin stuff on the side of it too. Like I'm negotiating contracts with the sponsors. I'm managing the giveaway. There's like, I had to go work with my lawyers to get terms and conditions written up and get video releases so that I can legally put, you know, the likeness of Jack on my channel. Like stuff like that is all, it's all just, there's a lot going into it. But to me, this is where, I think this is where the industry is going. And I'm, you know, placing a pretty big bet that I'm right with that hunch and that this is where the industry is going, because it just seems like, I don't know, I don't want to get on another Zoom call. I don't want to spend more time watching, like, you know, a direct to camera talking head with a screen share. Like I love that content when I'm trying to learn something directly, but it's not what I'm watching for fun. And instead I'm watching these reality competition shows. I'm watching, you know, like Anthony Bourdain, I'm watching the Great British Bake Off, and I want that, but for us, like built around the content that we care about and the things that we do for a living. So my hunch is that if we put the investment in, there's a big audience that wants to watch it. And I guess we're going to see how right I am in that assumption.
I've also been a part of large companies that will pay a large amount of money to get their tech used by tech influencers as well. So I think that's the other part of your bet, is that there's big tech companies, they're going to have some new tech that they want people to try out and be a part of a video, and are willing to write a substantial check to make it happen too.
And that's true. Like that's how I fund all, because, you know, it's not cheap to, like, just a director of photography on their own is like $2,000 a day. Right. So, so it's very expensive to get all the right people in place and to do all the editing and everything. But the companies are working with me to get, they want people to try their tech. They want, and what they're really after is they want a, you know, they like the webinar idea because a webinar is somebody demonstrating the code. They like the idea of events or meetups because it's people together kind of enjoying this thing as a group. They like conference talks because it's somebody explaining the value. And what I'm doing has the same benefits of all of those things because it's for devs building. So there's the community aspect, there's the giveaway, so there's a community aspect, there's the actual usage of the tool, so that's the webinar aspect. There's, you know, open source reference implementation, so that's like a sales tool. Like there's a lot of reasons why I think this is the right choice, because it ticks the same boxes as a lot of the stuff that we would do pre-pandemic, but it's being done in a way that even if you don't care about any of those benefits, it's still fun to watch this just as like a story about people solving a problem.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool to watch people make stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I feel like I'm assuming you're also a little bit careful too with which tech you pick. Like I think the Astro Vector DB is like perfect because it's just like, it's like a corporate entity clearly, but it's also something that I think your average developer would care about. Whereas imagine if like Oracle approached you and it's like, we have this great new enterprise integrated database, you'd probably be a little bit more hesitant.
That's
or ask for another zero on the contract.
Well, it's been a point of discussion that like we've got 4 hours to build, right? And so it has to be something that you can realistically build a web app with in 4 hours. And if in order to use it, you have to have an enterprise company that you can integrate with, like you know, like we can't do like a, like, I would love to work with a company like Okta, but if we worked with Okta and what they wanted to do was integrate SSO with an app, I don't have an app for them to integrate with. I don't have an employee directory to set up Skim with, and asking the devs to do that, it just doesn't make sense, right? So there are applications where, you know, there are things that you can do that work on TV and there are things that don't. And so there's a conversation about like, what are you trying to teach? Who are you trying to reach? And like, is this something that plays in 4 hours and actually gets to a result that you would be proud of as a company to see on screen? And a lot of times when we talk through that, we come to different conclusions. We start looking at different things that we would do instead.
Also, for what it's worth, for those saying 4 hours, it's not 4 hours for you to watch it.
No. The final cut is like 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah. It was 4 hours for us to make it. Well, and beyond.
Yeah, I think we added like an extra 20 minutes at the end because we...
Oh, yeah. But I mean, planning time and we had, you know...
The director's cut, which you can get on DVD, though. That's right. The longer...
Yeah.
Yeah, I have been kicking around the idea of like whether or not we could live stream the thing like into the Discord or something, like as a you know, if you wanted to watch it happen real time. I have to decide how that would be very painful to set up, so I have to decide if it's worth the pain, like if people are actually interested enough in watching a 8-hour live stream of film production.
You know, I gotta say, when you're talking about like the dinner after, it would be so funny to do one of like the Avengers end where they do the shawarma thing.
Yeah.
Like everybody just chilling out, eating shawarma in the studio. You know, that'd be hilarious. Yeah. And the other thing I was thinking about when you were talking, it was like, you know, be an interesting twist is like halfway through, you rotate projects.
Okay. I love that idea. I was kicking around, not that specifically, but there's this old idea that I saw at like South by Southwest that they called layer tennis. And it was designers would, they'd be working on Photoshop files and then a timer would go off and they had to swap files and like add a new layer and keep going. And then the timer would go off again and you'd get these absolutely ridiculous projects. I think that would be so much fun.
And you don't want to have people don't want to have downtime. So it's not like four people making one app and then like, you know, each kind of series. Cause then you got three people basically just waiting the entire time for that one person. No, but like if you had like, hey, okay, just we're going to flip a coin and then I'm going to finish your project and you're going to finish my project. And it's gonna like, oh my God, insanity would ensue.
That would be really funny.
It'd be, I just worry the context, right? That you just, because if you're handed somebody's app that's been in development for a bit, well, I mean, that could be part of the fun.
That's the fun.
Part of the fun.
Yeah. That's the fun, right, is how quickly can you ramp up on somebody else's code base? Because, I mean, you'd be working on something that's relatively small too, right? Like, what can you build in 45 minutes and then swap for the next 45 or something?
Yeah,
true.
So it would be, you can only write so many lines of code in 45 minutes. But it would be pretty dang funny if, you know, somebody, I don't know, installed like 55 NPM modules to get stuff done. And then like somebody gets that project and they're like, what is happening? How do I?
Right, exactly. It's just a combination. Yeah. You at least have to put together a README at the end, like, at the end of your segment.
AI install. Generates that.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, this sounds pretty awesome. For people listening, what's the best way if they want to check this out? Where hit me with the best link or the best place to go for this.
It'd be lwj.dev/4d1a.
Okay. I tell you what, we're going
to
get that link.
Desperately trying to figure out how to make that easier.
we're going to get that link in the show notes. So if you scroll down in your podcast player a little bit, you can find it there, unless you're really quick at memorizing letters.
I think unless you want to change the whole premise, you could probably just go with like 4devs.
I know. I really should. Like, yeah. I.
and to be honest, it's 4devs, 4apps.
That, oh, gee, God, no. No, Jack.
Anyway,
the name is terrible. I know. The name is terrible.
You got the dev domain. Could you get like 4.dev?
Oh, I wonder, God, if can you imagine?
I wonder if that's available. You probably pay like $500 a year.
Yeah, single character domain names, I feel like, are $5,000 or something.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were talking about like four.dev. I think you can get that.
Oh.
Maybe.
Yeah. No. The 4.dev.
No. If you're going to do it, you got to do it.
Yeah,
You got to do it like UI.dev. They spent like 30-something thousand dollars on that, and it absolutely paid off. I remember I was skeptical when they first bought that domain, and then they've been able to turn that into such a great business, and I was like, I never would have made that bet. Like, I never would have made the bet that a 30-something thousand dollar domain name was worth it.
So my company that I work for is called Blues, and part of the reason the founder Ray Ozzie picked it is because he owned blues.com. he's one of the early internet pioneers, so of course he's got this like laundry list of domains, and he owned blues.com. So here we are, and years later, making it work.
Wild.
I just looked at 4.today, FOR.today. Is only $10,000.
Only $10,000.
Yeah.
Only $10,000.
Bargains. One of our listeners is going to pick it up though. Now it's going to jack the price up.
That it's on sale. It's resale now for $20,000.
Okay. All right. This is going off the rails. Why don't we move into what is making us happy? Jack, what's making you happy this week?
maybe a repeat, but I gotta say Lightroom Mobile continues to make me happy. I just love that I can like bring this thing up on my phone. It's got a camera built in, and the cool like editing that I can do on these photos right on my phone as I'm like in line for a freaking coffee is just amazing. I'm loving that tool. I'm loving what it can do for my photos and how it can help me like bring light into this place and then, you know, dark into that place and shape the whole context of the photo is just so much fun. And it's free. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there is a subscription thing where you can get access to some of the AI tools. But, you know, it's free if you just want to use the kind of basic features of it. And I turned my sister onto it, and now she's, like, taking pictures of her dogs, and like, you know, and just really happy with her photography. I think it's just if you want an easy way to get into photography without buying yourself some crazy, you know, $3,000 SLR, you know, Lightroom Mobile is actually a really fun way to just try out.
Lightroom Mobile and a dog.
And a dog. Yeah, get yourself a dog. Get yourself some, you know, rent a kid. You know, kids are really, you know, they're photogenic, you know, like.
Yeah, just show up at a park. Just
exactly, like, you know. That's weirdly, it turns out that you can, this is actually getting into a weird area, but like you can take pictures of people in a public place and it actually is okay, at least in America.
Yeah, it's like, something like if you're okay in public spaces, then it's the whole thing.
Yeah, you don't
need some controversy about that.
I bet. Yeah.
Awesome. Is that Adobe Lightroom Mobile?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I didn't know that was free, so that's interesting. I might have to
check that out. You should check it out. Yeah.
All right. Well, what's making me happy is just this headline, and I'm going to read you guys headline because I want to get a reaction. So this is a quote. Firefox power user kept 7,500 tabs open for 2 years.
Oh, my God. How long?
2 years.
2 years. Wow.
I want stats.
That's just brutal.
I want stats. I want to know what percentage of those tabs were ever visited twice.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. I'm tempted now to attempt this for science and see at what point this breaks down. But apparently this came from somebody had done this and had reached out and through support mechanisms because Firefox, as you might imagine, was having trouble restoring a session that had 7,500 tabs open. I will say, though, the reason this is making me happy is because Jack knows at least that I am a big Firefox fan. Yes. And partially because historically using Chrome, memory was just running out of control. And I would be doing things like video editing. And I don't have 4 terabytes of video, but I work with decent sized video. And then if I have a few Chrome tabs up, it was getting out of control. So I switched to Firefox several years ago, and it's been great. Now, I have not quite yet attempted 7,500 tabs, but it's nice to know that if my browser, if I need to go up there, my browser can totally handle it.
It hurts my soul. My wife has like one of the inboxes where she keeps like 5,000 messages in the inbox.
Yep.
And it just hurts me. And just I get cold sweats after I get like maybe 3 or 4 tabs open. I'm so like, oh, do I know? You know, 75. I just can't even imagine.
Was actually like Arc has a whole bunch of hype going on and they're doing all sorts of things. I don't care about any of it. The reason I use Arc is because Arc auto closes tabs after 24 hours. They just disappear. And I've never once been sad and thought to myself, where was that tab? Like, I'm just free.
You know, I do end up, I will say, there's like this fine line between, I use Arc too, and there's like these persistent tabs, and then there is, so I do actually have like maybe 10 tabs open at any time, and then there are these kind of transient tabs, and then those are the ones that go away after 24 hours, and it's I end up actually using Notion to kind of hold, like if I'm like, oh wow, I looked at this, that's kind of cool, I want to keep this around kind of thing, I'm like, okay, now I can actually take that URL, shoot it over into Notion, because I know that like, the next day, I'm going to be like, wait, I wanted that. It's gone. What?
Yep. I'm the same way, except I just have a notes.markdown file that I just
keep. There you go.
And it's just one markdown file. It stores my life, more or less. And I don't know. I think everybody's got their own sort of system that they come up with.
Yep.
And apparently for this person, it was 7,500 tabs in Firefox.
Oh, God. What?
Does Firefox even have, like, tab folders? Like, can you group them? Or this YOLO, like 7,500 independent tabs, just can't even see the favicon anymore.
This is an article
that was long gone.
This is an article that was published on techspot.com, and they reached out to get a Mozilla representative to comment on it. And their quote from this, like, I don't know, whoever at Mozilla is, "While we think it's amazing that anyone has 7,000 plus active tabs, it also shows the degree to which tab management is a common problem. We plan to roll out improved profile systems and tab management capabilities later in 2024. So
specifically for this one power user.
Perfect. Yeah. Mozilla not letting a good story go to rest. They're plugging their upcoming tab management capabilities.
I love it.
Good. Good.
Jason, what's making you happy this week?
What is making me happy is Node.js. And I say this. So I just had Matteo Colina on my other show, Learn with Jason, where it's like 90 minutes of pair programming. And Matteo is a core member. He's like the vice chair of the TSC committee. And what I've realized is my impression of Node was stuck like 5 years ago. And so I was thinking about Node 14 and like Node 14's feature set. And when I would hear people complain about like ESM and CJS compatibility, I'd hear them complain about all the modules you need to start a project. Oh, you need this for watching. You need this for TypeScript. You need this for, you need separate modules for the file system, separate modules for globbing, separate modules for whatever. I was like, oh, well, yeah. I mean, that's just kind of how Node is, right? But like, what else are we going to do? And then people started putting pressure on, like Bun and so on, talking about their feature sets. And I saw this kind of offhand comment from Matteo, which is like, well, if people would look at modern Node, they would realize that all those things already exist. So I started looking into it. And then Matteo came on the show today, and I realized, like, watch mode is built into Node these days. You can import inside of a common JS file. You can like require an EJS file. You can do styled text like what you used to have import chalk for. You can bring in, you can do globbing. You can, like, the utils in Node that are built in now are out of control. Like, all of this stuff is truly excellent and like truly native. So I had Matteo on, and we were able to build three or four common things. We built a server. We did a CLI, like got command line args and did some colored output from those. And then we also looked at watching a folder for file changes so that we could like stream that file in and make changes to it. Like, all of that worked with the only dependency being TypeScript.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away at how wrong my preconceptions were about Node as a platform. Like, it's truly like Node 22 is excellent, and it does all these things that people complain they wish Node would do. It's like, no, it's there, just upgrade Node.
You know, I watched a video a couple months ago, really well done, on PHP. Now the new PHP is nothing like kind of what you remember from the old days of PHP, and it was like oh, this was cleaned up, and that's been cleaned up, and this is not your father's. Like, that would be a video I'd love to see. I'm kind of with you. Like, I use Node colon a couple things, but I'm like, I still bring in Node mon. I still,
Yeah, exactly. And all that stuff is fine, but you just don't need it anymore. You don't need Node mon. You don't need chalk. You don't need watch. You don't, like, they're all just built in now. So it's that really made me happy. I feel like, it's always nice when you have a conversation, and the conversation I had with Matteo was one of those ones where I felt excited about technology that I thought I was done learning. And I feel like Node is one of those things that I kind of felt like I was done. I was like, well, I know enough about Node. I don't need to learn. It's not going to be exciting anymore. It's just a tool now. And then I had that conversation, and I walked away thinking, like, this is actually great. Like, what a great community. What a great project. And it does a lot of cool stuff, and it improves consistently. Like, going back through what has changed since Node 14, which was the last time that I really gave it like a strong like look through of what was in there, it's miles beyond where it was then, and has been, every single major release they're doing something really cool with it. So definitely worth, if you've been thinking of Node as being stuck in the Node 14 or previous feature set, like, time to give it a look. It might make you happy.
Yeah, and I think this competition, Dino and Bun mm-hmm. and such, is definitely giving them something to basically just helped force the issue to get some of this stuff moving. And hey, it's good for us. It means we get more and more interesting and cool stuff to play around with.
Well, and I think that's actually the thing that's really interesting is I brought that up, and Mateo was like, well, no, we've been working on it. The problem for us is we won't break backward compatibility. So like things that were written, you know, Express will run in node 0.12 and it will run in node 22, and you don't have to do compatibility choices. Like, we don't break backward compatibility. So that to me was like, that's why they've been a little slower to get stuff out. But the other problem is they don't have money for a marketing department. So where companies like Dino are able to go send everybody swag and like put up landing pages and stuff, Node's relying on volunteers to write posts. And most of the posts that we see were written 10 years ago. And so we're seeing 10-year-old Node code still taught today as like the right way to write Node. So I think a lot of it is like we as a community have a big opportunity to go out and like really kind of take over that space. If you wanted to become well-known as a content creator right now, get into that Node space and teach people modern Node, because there's so much that hasn't been covered, and the Node community would boost it hard because they're really desperately trying to get these old posts to fall off of SEO.
Man, that Node 0.12 stuff, though, that stuff's got to be doing gangbusters.
I guess, Jason, you know, when you get a chance, connect me with this guy. I would love to do some of that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Awesome. Well, hey, Jason, this has been a ton of fun. Thank you for joining us. Is there anything else you want people to know? Any other links? Like, if they want to follow you, what else should people know? Where should they go?
I mean, the easiest place, I've got everything that I do linked up in some form or another off of my my little link tree that I built, jason.energy/links. Because I can't just have a normal domain.
Jason.energy. I didn't even know that one.
So I used to have Jason.af, Jason and right then there. I found out that one was directly funding the Taliban. So I got rid of that one and moved over to Jason.energy. I know. It was a whole thing.
Wait.
I didn't think about it. Okay. I bought this years ago, and I was like, .af, that's a really funny domain name.
Oh, Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. And then we pulled out of Afghanistan as a country, and then the Taliban became the government, and suddenly when you buy a .af domain, you're funding the government, which is the... So I fixed that, and so now I'm at jason.energy because I couldn't find jason.anything else. I also own jason.rip, but I thought that might send the wrong message.
Yeah, you're future-proofing, though. You gotta... That's if you want to have the most like clever obituary or like will situation ever, you could set something up fancy there.
Hook myself up to a dead man switch that just auto redirects to that domain once I stop ticking.
It just changes the DNS record, and then there you go. All right.
Oh, jeez.
We'll link those up in the show notes. This is a lot of fun, man. But yeah, this is a ton of fun. Thanks again for joining us. And yeah. Thanks, everybody else, and until next week.
See you then.